Hello, and welcome to Speaking with Joy, a podcast about books, beauty, and music. So make yourself a cup of tea, sit down, and let's begin. Say not the struggle not availeth, the labor and the wounds are vain. The enemy faints not nor faileth, and as things have been, they remain. If hopes were dupes, fears may be liars. It may be, and yon smoke concealed, your comrades chase, e'en now the flyers, and but for you possess the field. For while the tired waves, vainly breaking, seem here no painful inch to gain, far back through creeks and inlets making, comes silent flooding in the main. And not by eastern windows only, when daylight comes in the light. In from the sun climbs slow, how slowly, but westward look, the land is bright. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Reading with Joy, as we're having now with the book club. That is from a poem by Arthur Hugh Clough, and it's called Say Not the Struggle Not Availeth, which is to say, do not say that the struggle is not availing. And it is quoted in one of the chapters for this week. This was pointed out to me again by Emma from Bristol, who pointed out something lovely last week as well. And I think it sets up well what we're going to talk about this week and some of the elements of the chapters and what's moving into taking place in this book. Now, I'm going to tell you ahead of time that this will be in two parts because I recorded some discussion with Joel last night. So what I'll do is I'll do this part, I'll kind of give you an overview of what's happening and I'll just talk through the chapters with you. And then I'll switch over to what I recorded with Joel last night where we talk about some of the more theoretical things behind it. So first, let me give you just kind of a reminder of what is happening. So at the end of chapter one, he gets on the bus with the tousle-haired poet, or Joel and I had a conversation about how you pronounce this, who he finds out is very kind of depressed and everything went against him and all this stuff. And that's a theme you'll see over and over again, is everyone kind of has a reason, all these very kind of self-centered reasons why their life didn't work out. And then you go on to this next fellow, and he starts to kind of describe the town more in detail. And at this point, we start to, now that we're kind of out of the town, we can find out about it. And what we find out is it's basically this endless sprawl of suburbia that's mostly empty. That's how he describes the town. And it's funny, it reminds me of, Joel and I talked in January about the album by the Arcade Fire called Suburbs? I think it's just called Suburbs. And it kind of describes this almost apocalyptic world of the suburbs. And one of the things they talk about in there over and over again, which really applies to this, is the sense of the suburbs being a place of isolation. And that's something I've really sensed since moving to the UK, where I'm in less of a suburban setting, is that in the suburbs in America, you can live in your little house, you can drive to your job in your little box of a car, and you can come back, and if you didn't try, you would never have to talk to your neighbors. So there's a sense in which it's very, very isolating. And to Lewis, this is how he begins to develop the idea of hell, which is where we kind of find out that all these people were, at least sort of, that'll come in later. We'll discuss kind of the nature of these places later, but this is meant to be something like hell. And one of the key elements of this place is that it's isolating. And he uses this kind of vision of a suburban area that's just a sprawling, empty place as this image of hell. And he talks about how everyone's always quarrelsome. And so it's an endless sprawl of suburbia because everybody keeps on getting in fights and then separating and getting further and further apart. And he talks about like the most impressive people are the most isolated. So they just continue to spread out and isolate away from each other to the point where they're millions of miles apart and where like the most known people are millions of miles apart. And this is a really key thing for Lewis because at the center of what it is to turn away from reality, which is also for Lewis to say to turn away from God, is to turn inward. We started to talk about that last week. It's to stop wanting to connect and be in relationship with God and the world, and instead to turn inward. And this is really obvious, too, with all of the people that we're talking with, right? You have the tousle-haired poet who just talks on and on about himself and how everything was everyone else's fault, and you can see this kind of way that it becomes much more and more isolated. And then even with let's see, you know, you have all these different people who are just they're very self-centered. And so Tuhel is pictured as this endless suburbia where people continue to get further and further apart by infinite miles because they continue to be separated because they are so self-centered. And this is humorously depicted through Napoleon, who they finally find him millions of miles away. And it says that he's walking back and forth going, it was Soult's fault, it was Ney's fault, it was Josephine's fault, it was the fault of the Russians, it was the fault of the English. And so you see that it's like Napoleon has become so isolated, and he just sits there saying why it's everyone else's fault because he's totally isolated himself. And also, if you are thinking, well, it's kind of rude to just decide who's in hell and who's in heaven, well, yes, it is. But also, this is very much in the tradition of someone like Dante, who, of course, Dante also ends up going on this trip through heaven and he goes through hell, purgatory, and heaven. And when he was writing it, and he writes it in a similar way, I talk about this with Joel, he writes it in a similar way to Lewis in that he's writing it as Dante, in the same way that Lewis seems to be writing this as Lewis. And it's kind of in this dreamlike state where he kind of just awakens in the middle of a wood and is drawn into this world. But Dante also did this, and he actually got in a lot of trouble for it. He would put living popes in hell in his story, which was a bold move, one might say. So that's kind of what you see happening here. But yeah, so we have this image of these people becoming more and more isolated, and whether it's Napoleon or the quarrelsome poet, they're just pushed further and further away from each other because they're so self-centered and self-absorbed. And Joel and I will talk more about that in the next segment, about kind of what that imaging, and that it's imaging this idea of self-love instead of love of God and love of others in God. And then, of course, you get this fellow who thinks that he can fix it by making there be scarcity. So let's see, where is it? He says, oh, you get everything you want just by imagining it. He says, this is what happens in hell. And that's why it never costs any trouble to move to another street or build another house. In other words, there's no proper economic basis for any community life. If they needed real shops, chaps would have to stay near where the real shops were. And so he has this whole thing where his idea is to start a business and then to create scarcity and everyone will draw close. But of course, the point here is that there is something bigger than just an economic issue with these people. And I think what's interesting to me is that Lewis, with these other ghosts and people that he corresponds with, all of them kind of have these competing ideas of what the human condition is and what the problem with humans is. Lewis is depicting it as this continual isolation. And all the people he talks to have different reasons for why they think that is. So this fellow just thinks that it's economic. If you could just fix the economics, you would fix the human problem. And of course, we always see that in our world, don't we? People kind of wanting to fix human problems with economics. And that's not to say, or with science, or with art. When you have the intellectual who says, well, if you just fix all their intellect, it'll be fine. And there's a sense that, of course, those things can contribute, but those are not at the ultimate heart of it, what is going wrong with this sprawling hellscape suburbia. So then we get to another interesting thing about this place, and that's something that some of you all asked about, is the sense of the light. And at the very beginning, when we walk into this town, chapter one, it's at the edge of evening, and it's kind of this dull, dreary time when you can't tell, it's not quite night yet, and none of the shops are on. And then at the end of this chapter, you have this beautiful part where he says, I glanced around the bus, and the windows were closed and soon muffed, but the bus was full of light, and the light still grew. And so you always have this kind of playing with this idea of light. And what this comes to be is this image of both the sun setting and the sun rising, and whether the sun is setting or rising. And this, I think, is really Lewis's kind of way of imagining, will there ever be a final judgment? Because you kind of get the feeling with all these people that that there's an in-between, right? Because when you're in the town, which we think is hell, there's not the sense that it's a punishment place. It's just kind of this weird existence. And so there's always this question of, is there going to be a final moment where the sun really sets, or a final moment where the sun really rises? And that's Lewis's kind of image of judgment. And that comes up with this poem that I opened with and that Emma noticed, and that this fellow who thinks everyone's superstitious comes on about. And he says, "Oh, I beg your pardon. Oh, God bless my soul. That's all it is. There's not a shred of evidence that this twilight is ever going to turn into night. There's been a revolution of opinion on that in educated circles. I'm surprised you haven't heard of it. All the nightmare fantasies of our ancestors are being swept away. What we now see is a subdued and delicate half-light, is the promise of dawn, the slow turning of a whole nation towards the light. Slow and imperceptible, of course, and not through eastern windows only, when the daylight comes in the light." And the passion for the real commodities, which our friend speaks of, is only materialism, you know. It's retrogressive, earthbound, a hankering for matter. But we look on this spiritual city, for with all its faults, it is spiritual, a nursery in which the creative functions of man, now freed from the clogs of matter, begin to try their new wings. A sublime thought. So he's basically saying that he says, you know, oh, the night will never really come. And by that, he says, there's never going to be a judgment. We're slowly but surely moving towards, I think what he's saying is we're moving towards an age of progress in which we'll just move infinitely towards this light. And he also says that we'll move towards a spiritual reality, you know, that we're going to transcend all of these matterly issues. We won't need food or houses or things anymore. It's really spiritual. But of course, right after this, we have the strangeness of the hard world that he enters into. And so he contradicts that. So that's, I think, I would say, as we continue reading, to have that idea of the light and the sense of it being this question of, will there be this kind of final moment of judgment or of redemption? Because you have this playing with, is the night going to finally come in the town, or will the dawn finally really rise in this kind of heavenly place? Because of course, when you get to the heavenly place, he says, "The light and coolness that drenched me were like those of the sunny summer morning, a minute or two before the sunrise." So you have this sense of it's a minute or two before darkness in the town, and a minute or two before sunrise in the heavenly place. And that is this picture of, are we headed towards dawn? Are we headed towards a final moment of judgment or of redemption? And that's reflected in this poem that I read at the beginning, because he's saying, basically, is all of this struggling for naught? Or is there a dawn coming that we can't quite see? And that has both this ominous level, because is that, you know, is it the sunset or the sunrise? But the sense that you can see the light that is being cast from the east, even on the western place where you'd think it would be sunsetting. So I'm just blah, blah, blahing, but I'm going to pass this on now to the discussion that Joel and I had last night, which is more about the next chapter and why the earth is hard and why these people continue to choose not to want to stay in the heavenly place, and why you see all these people running away and why it is that they have turned away from the reality. Also, before I go, note that this fellow who quotes the poem says, we'll go into a spiritual reality where things aren't full of this kind of matter, this earthiness. But then you get into the heavenly world, and it is hard as rocks. It is more earthy. It is more real than the place was before. So now I'll hand you on to the next discussion that Joel and I had last night. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Speaking with Joy. I have my very kind but slightly beleaguered brother with me. Say hello, Joel.
Hello.
We are back in the recording closet and are draped over with a scarf and many nice Oxford cloth shirts here to talk to you about The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. Now, this week we went through chapters 2 through 4, and I sent out and asked you all for some questions. So mainly today, Joel and I will be talking over the questions that you all brought up. But before we do that, let me kind of do a quick overview of what happened in the last 3 chapters. So in the end of chapter 1, he just gotten on the bus. And in chapter 2, he talks with the, how did we decide this word is said, Joel?
Tousled?
Tousled?
Sarah? Tousle-headed? Tousle, he would say Tousle. My sister Sarah would say Tousled, which I just don't like the sound of. And I would say Tousled, just to avoid all of the weird noises that that makes. He talks to this fill-in-the-blank haired poet.
Yes.
And he is hard-pressed by life, and he's a victim, and everything goes wrong. And it's funny because the narrator is kind of like, should I feel bad for him? I can't tell if I should feel bad for him. and then all of a sudden they crest the hill and they are looking at something new. He glanced round the bus and through the windows were closed and soon muffled. The bus was full of light. It was a cruel light. It shrank from the faces and forms from which I was surrounded. They were all fixed faces, full not of possibilities, but of impossibilities. Some gaunt, some bloated, some glaring with idiotic ferocity, some drowned beyond recovery in dreams. But all, in one way or another, distorted and faded. So that will become really important. We'll talk about that in a minute. So he gets up there, and he gets into this place. What is it, Joel? Is it heaven? Is it purgatory? What is it?
It's a mystery.
We'll talk more about that later because we have a guide, a kind of Virgil-esque guide, but we won't get to that yet.
Indeed.
So just for the people who said, is this heaven, is this hell, what is it? We'll talk about that later.
For those of you who do know your Dante and other things like that, just another little hint is just to know that this is, like we said in the first episode, this is always in keeping with the repertoire of great allegorical books that are always referencing some sort of theological thing. So if you know your Augustine and Dante, then you might be able to spot
pick things up. But for those who don't know Dante, famously in the Commedia, which is the comedy, which is goes through this journey that Dante takes from hell to purgatory to heaven. Mm-hmm. It says, it begins with midway in my life and confused. He like wakes up in a wood and is taken through. So it kind of begins in a very similar way to this. Mm-hmm. And in the same way as this book, there's kind of this confusion of, is the poet writing as himself? Is he writing as a character like himself? And so you kind of have that with Lewis, and that'll become more obvious as to why he's doing that. And then he makes his way through this. So, okay, so we arrive in this mysterious place. And one of the things that we most notice about this, and it already is being hinted at through this light, is the sense that it's a hard place, that it's a solid, sturdy, and that it's almost kind of dangerously sturdy.
Well, and even, I mean, especially though, I mean, it's that the characters themselves are, even before they see the place itself, they are insubstantial. They are, what does it say?
It says, they were in fact ghosts, man-shaped stains on the brightness of that air. Yeah. One could attend them or ignore them at will, as you would with dirt on a window pane. Oh, and he says, and I noticed the grass did not bend under their feet. Even the dewdrops were not disturbed. So this is one of the main questions people had is, what is this about? Mm-hmm. And this will come up more, but I wanted to explain to you all, this is something we can learn about in this reading group, and I'm sure some of you have encountered this before, but the idea of sin as privation and how this plays into role with the story that we have here. So the famous person for this, of course, is Augustine. And remember that this always ends up tying back to that idea of desire and how desire is the force that pulls us towards God. So for Augustine, he says that we receive our being in God, and that our being is always meant to kind of face towards God, that we're meant to relate to him and relate to the world that he has given us and relate to other people. And that as we do that, we kind of gain our identity and our being. And so our being is meant to be this outward-facing thing that is in relationship with God or relationship to the world. And he says that sin is when we turn, and for him, desire is the thing that pulls us towards God, towards the natural world, and towards other relationships. And to him, sin is what he calls the inward curve. It's when instead of focusing our desires and our loves outside ourselves and attaching them to things outside of ourselves, we attach them to ourselves. Now, because God is a source of being, and because we kind of get our identity and our being through God and through loving things in God. So if I love my neighbor, if I love Joel, I just slapped his shoulder. I am loving him in God because God created him. So through loving something outside of myself, I continue to kind of have that outward push of my being. But if I turn that inwards and love myself, I begin to become diminished because I am not reality. And so if I cut myself off from reality, by loving myself rather than loving God, but by using desire for myself rather than using desire to look outside of myself, then I begin to become diminished.
And this is important for Augustine because, as you can probably start to perceive from what Joy is saying, the point of this is that reality, all of creation, is sustained by God for mm-hmm. Augustine. That it's not just our sort of relationship with him, but it's our relationship in the context of this creation with him and mm-hmm. in the context of the world and in the time that we live. And so turning into ourselves in that sense is not a small movement from a thing to another thing. It's a very, it's giving up a massive amount to have a very, very, very small thing.
It reminds me of, and this has to do with the tousled-haired poet, there's this quote in G.K. Chesterton where he says that the church has always looked poorly on suicide because to say no to life is not just to say no to yourself, it's to turn your back on the entire world. Mm-hmm. And in a lesser form, that's kind of what Augustine says we do when we turn inward, is that we, when we love ourselves and love God through the world, we say no to the whole world. And so for Augustine, that literally diminishes our being, right? And, this is also very Platonic because in Plato, you have this idea of being drawn towards God. And as you be drawn towards God, you become even more real. Mm-hmm. And so what Lewis is doing with this idea is he's trying to, kind of put that into play imaginatively
yeah.
in a really concrete way. So you have all these ghosts who are really self-involved, who have turned their capacity for desire inward. Yeah. And so they're literally pictured as being less substantial than this heavenly place.
Yeah. And it's set up by this ghost that he's just had this conversation with.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very connected to their first encounter with the place itself.
Exactly. And so what you can see is all these people from the town, as he calls it, are people who are one way or another are self-involved, who've turned their self inward. And this is actually really obvious with the poet, right? Because everything was about him and everything was against him and everything. Right. So it's always this very kind of like me
inward
focused
turn. Yeah.
And because of that, he has lost his substantiality because we have to have, and it's funny, I've thought about this even with like psychologically, they say that, children develop their sense of self based on their relationships with others. And so even psychologically, that's true. And if you totally isolated someone, they would go crazy. And that's kind of the sense. So I also think it's interesting that, where is it? He says, I think it's at the end of this chapter. It says, at the very end, it says, two of the ghosts screamed and ran from the bus. The rest of us huddled closer to one another. And that's like their step towards. And I remember when I was doing my dissertation, talking about how that idea of moving towards people, even as you're not moving towards God, moving towards other people is the sense of going out of yourself. And so for them, that's like their first step into staying in the real place.
That's right. It's communing with each other.
Yeah. So the idea, I'm just blah, blah, blah.
It's great. Keep going.
So, so this idea of the world being hard, it's not like a punishment. It's the sense that these people have become so diminished by their self-involvement and by being self-centered, that they, literally self-centered, that they have become less substantial. And so when they're in this world that is reality, that's pulsating with God's presence in it, they almost can't stand in it because
they've become detached from reality. The question, I think, what the book wants us to ask at the beginning here is, which reality is the real reality? Because your first perception is of this sort of pretty substantial gray world. And so when they come up into this new world, the question is this some sort of like alien experience, or
is it being invited further in?
Yeah, yeah. What are it? You know, why are they ghosts? Why do they suddenly become non-entities in that sense? And it's wrapped up in this Augustinian question.
Yeah, and I think also that goes with this idea that people often talk about, like heaven as being this kind of ethereal place where people play harps and we're all spirits. And Lewis is like doing the opposite of that. He's saying no, it's not exchanging a physical, real, tangible, touchable world for a kind of ethereal one.
Although he's very clever about this because he keeps on talking about the light because he does want to sort of maintain the light as this center point for this embodiment. So instead of it becoming sort of the more traditional Platonic sense of sort of becoming disembodied and sort of going into this unimagined sort of expression. He is basically saying there's a connectivity between going toward a heavenly light and
going towards,
having more embodiment,
yeah,
and becoming more sort of rooted in reality, yeah, and in the world.
And a fun fact is that that is like the trajectory that a lot of early Christian writers took when they kind of began to,
yep,
engage with Platonism, was to say that the idea of there being a reality beyond the material world, which is what Platonism says, is really good. But what Jesus and his resurrected body shows us is that we're drawn beyond the material world into a more fully realized material world. So
right,
it's not kind of a vague disembodiment. So then something that you start to see with these characters is they are all in one way or another disconnected from reality and focused on themselves. And this is, I can't remember if I talked about this last week, but Augustine has two kinds of love. He says, ultimately, love is either love of God or love of self. And you might say, well, but I also love ice cream and I also love, like,
right,
my siblings. So what would that be? And for him, what he says is that if we love our siblings in God, then we're loving God. So it's a sense of, if I love my siblings not as things to use, but I love them as gifts of grace from God, then I'm loving God. But if I love my siblings because I like the feelings they make for me,
yeah,
then I'm ultimately not loving my siblings. I'm loving myself because I'm loving what is produced in me by my siblings.
Lewis has talked about this as well in other wonderful writings. A lot of the time what you can do with Lewis is you can look at his nonfiction writing and sort of see it as a prototype of his fiction writing, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So Abolition of Man is prototypical of his book, That Hideous Strength. I think a book that might be prototypical, or actually it's not a book, it was a sermon. But
yes, absolutely.
A sermon that is very prototypical of this book is The Weight of Glory, which,
yeah,
talks about desire. And one of the things that he starts right at the beginning with is sort of this idea of Christian denial and how much,
mm-hmm,
it feels like it means that we're sort of putting our desire, we're sort of truncating our desires. Let's see, Joy's pulling it up right now. Yeah, this is,
yeah,
it. So no, I know where it is. It's actually at the top.
Oh.
He starts by saying, the New Testament has a lot to say about self-denial. We're told to deny ourselves, to take up our cross.
Read that slower, they're not going to be able to hear you.
Yeah. I submit that this notion is crept in. So he says, if there lurks in most modern minds the notion that to desire our own good and earnestly to hope for this enjoyment is a bad thing, I submit that this notion has crept in from Kant and the Stoics and is no part of the Christian faith. Indeed, if we consider the unblushing promises of reward and the staggering nature of the rewards promised in the Gospels, it would seem that our Lord,
mm-hmm,
finds our desires not too strong, but too weak.
Mm-hmm.
We are half-hearted creatures fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered to us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased. And so this is sort of, I think, a good starting point in terms of Lewis's nonfiction for understanding,
mm-hmm,
what he's trying to imaginatively do,
yeah,
with this moment right now,
yeah,
as it's like they can't even imagine a place,
yeah,
that would be this embodied. Their desires haven't pushed far enough into,
yeah,
the fullness of what they could be.
Well, and that's what we saw right in the first couple chapters, the kind of listlessness, this kind of being satisfied to be in this boring place because they have learn to love themselves more than they want to love God. And so, yeah, that's a perfect. Thank you for the give-out, Joel. I was going to bring that in at some point, but I'm glad you brought it in here.
Good.
So then you can see that the whole arc of this book is learning not to be, as he put it, the half-hearted creatures fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered to us. So what they're being invited into is infinite joy. And that kind of casts the scene that you start to see then in this first scene with the first ghost, right? So we have the employer and the employee ghost. And so what you want to be looking for in the rest of these scenes is how are they self-loving and not pursuing infinite joy, rather than, you know, in the way they're doing this. So in this scene, you have this ghost who is determined. The thing that he's caught on, the thing that he can't get over, is the sense that he's a good man. He's done right all of his life. I put this on the discussion board, but I think this is the line that sticks out to me most, is when the spirit says to him, you weren't a good man. You weren't a decent man. You didn't do your best. We none of us were, and we none of us did. Lord bless you, doesn't matter. There's this sense that the ghost, who's the, you know, obviously the unredeemed man, he wants to hold on to, I am enough on my own. I can vindicate my own righteousness.
Well, the funny thing is he's appealing to a universal sense of justice and rightness. Yeah. So, but he's appealing to it in a way that says that he gets to sort of decide how it's mediated, and he gets to own it, and he gets to sort of deal with it according to how he has sort of mediated in his own heart.
Yes.
It's this inward turn to his understanding of it.
It's what you see with all of the ghosts rather than spirits is there's always a sense of isolation, of wanting to be separated and defend themselves. They're separated from God, from other people, whether that's because they're special, like with the tousled-haired poet. So he's kind of proud of himself because he's special and he was just oppressed. Or this guy, when he says, well, I am the one who did the best and I did my duty and nobody sees it. There's a sense of being kind of pushed away. And he wants to be able to, whatever he wants to say is, I want to be able to say that I've done it on my own. I've done my best and I've defined it. Mm-hmm. And then I think, do you have anything else to say about that, Joel?
Mm-mm. And, that's a good point. I think I would just I think it's interesting how often this sort of inwardness is built around the idea of a universal, built around the idea of transcendence, when it's only using transcendence for its own ends, you know.
Yeah. Okay. So a really good picture of this invitation towards that's my mom texting me. This invitation towards infinite happiness is when you have the spirit and he says to him, who knows whether you will be, only be happy and come with me. So this is invitation into joy, which is also an invitation out of the man's self, out of his, you know, whatever.
It's, and then it's also says, an invitation out of the idea of happiness and thinking about what reality. It is. And into, this is actually, another, again, Lewis, all Lewis's ideas, if you just look far enough into his nonfiction, you'll find them. But there's another spot where he talks about, I'm trying to remember the essay, where he says, when you're enjoying something, you don't think about what it is, you just enjoy it.
It's in The Myth Became Fact. He says, you don't. It's not the idea of the thing, it's the thing itself.
Yeah.
So in this, he says, only forget about this and be happy and come with me. So this is the invitation of the spirit. And the guy, the ghost, says, what do you keep on arguing for? I'm only telling you the sort of chap that I am. So remember, he wants to be able to define who he is and not let anyone else define him. I only want my rights. And that's something else, too, is the sense of my rights is kind of the picture of being the self-autonomous. I don't need other people because I have my rights and you owe something to me. And he says, I'm not asking for anyone's bleeding charity. And then the spirit says to him, then do at once. Ask for the bleeding charity. Everything is here for the asking and nothing can be bought. And I love this, first of all, because Lewis is making a little pun, right? Because saying, I'm not asking for your bleeding charity would be a very, it's kind of a profane thing to say. Mm-hmm. But then the spirit turns into the bleeding charity as in the
blood of the cross.
Blood on the cross, yeah. It's Jesus' charity to you. And which ultimately says nothing is ours by right, but everything is ours by gift. It's that invitation into ultimate and complete joy.
Right. By self, letting go of oneself and living into the joy of the reality that awaits beyond.
Yeah. And this is something that the murderer ghost particularly understands, right? Because he realized he has a keener sense of his need because he realizes that he couldn't define himself as good after this moment. And so he knows that he needs mercy. And the other ghost needs mercy just as much, but he's holding on to this idea that he can define himself and he doesn't need anybody outside of himself. And as he does that, he becomes more and more diminished. And then you end with this kind of sad thing saying, in the end, still grumbling, but whimpering a little as he picked his way over the sharp grass, it made off. So this picture of he chose not to be invited into reality. He would rather define himself and stay independent than to be able to move outwards.
Yeah, and he would also rather just have his... He does want a universal reality. He just doesn't want the universal reality that's actually real. He wants one that he has defined. Imagined for himself, that he has built. And so he can't be real within this space because the real that he wants doesn't exist. And that goes, again, back to this idea that sin is privation, that sin is... Sort of, Aquinas actually talks about this as when you sin, you don't exist. You move away from existence. Yeah. It's in keeping with that Augustinian tradition.
I think I use the phrase as infinitely regressive. When you turn in on yourself, there's nothing to attach yourself to.
Right.
And so you just become less and less. And I think that is both a really interesting philosophical context, idea, But it's also, I think for me, it's made me think very personally about what does it mean for me to think about self-love versus love of God? Do I live my life turning in and becoming isolated? Do I want to hold on to my rights and my ability to define who I am? Or do I have an outward-facing look towards God, towards other people, and even towards the earth, towards the realness and the beauty of goodness?
Yeah, I think we recently, this could have its own full conversation, but mm-hmm. I'll just say in very much in passing that we recently had a movie night in which we watched the movie The Tree of Life, and one of the major themes throughout that film is sort of there's a conflict that's constantly going throughout the storyline, but there's all these mediating moments of beauty in nature, and a lot of the differentiation between various characters is who notices it and who doesn't.
Yeah.
And it's kind of recognizing that the world we live in is difficult, but how are we dealing with the difficulty? Are we allowing it the beauty to break in, or are we wanting to claim our stance of understanding and be able to say, well, yeah, this can't be beautiful because this thing that I've understood about, whatever it may be, I want to control my engagement with reality,
yeah,
rather than saying, I'm going
to
let it
reality
go.
Reality is given to me.
Yeah, reality is given. And with whatever is difficult for me, there is also beauty which breaks in all of the time.
Yeah. Okay. And there's one last thing that you just reminded me of. It reminds me, and particularly this scene with the employer, reminds me of Javert from Les Mis, if any of you have ever read that. And it's interesting because in Les Mis, you have Javert and Jean Valjean are these very similar characters in funny ways. They have a similar arc, which is that both of them have a pivotal moment where they experience mercy. So Jean Valjean is very much like this murderer, right? He comes to the moment where he steals this very opening. He steals the candlesticks of the generous bishop after Jean Valjean has been let out of jail. And when the police come to rightfully take him away, the bishop says he gave them to him. And he says, go start a new life. And at that point, Jean Valjean cannot define who he is anymore. He has lost the right, if you want to use that word, to define who he is. And his option is to say yes to a life that is given to him that he did not define the space of, if that makes sense. And he says yes, and he moves forward. But then you have Javert, and Javert lives totally by the law his entire life. And it's kind of that similar with the employer, where he wants to be able to define who he is, define what is just and what is right. But then there comes, I'm not going to spoil the plot, but there comes this moment where he gets mercy. And Javert would rather end his own life than have an existence that's defined for him by grace.
It's, in a sense, reality becomes distorted to Javert because
he can't define it anymore.
What he does is he uses this law that he lives according to, and he bases his understanding of reality around that law to such an extent, to such an unbending way that he follows the law to the nth degree. But it leads him into absurdity. It leads him into realizing that the way that he has lived his life means nothing. It's meaningless. It doesn't accord with reality because reality is too filled with grace, and grace constantly sort of breaks into this unforgiving law that he is so attached to.
Yes, and one of the things with Javert is that he doesn't want, there's a certain kind of person who's allowed in Javert's heaven. In the same way, there's a certain kind of person that is allowed into this employer's heaven. And the employer would rather not be in heaven than be with that particular kind of person.
Yeah.
And part of that is out of this idea that he can define who's in, who's out, who's right, who's wrong. And part of the point of this is that reality is given to us and grace is given to us, and you don't get to decide who is given grace.
Yeah.
And so turning away from heaven because the people you didn't like, or the people who didn't look like you, or the people who didn't do exactly what you would have done, is a form of turning inward, because you would rather reject the extravagant grace that God gives to others. You'd rather reject it for yourself because you don't want to be those people. We have blah, blah, blah. I'm not sure. I hope that you've gotten something good in it. I would just love to see you guys comment in chat. So go on the Twitter, go on the Facebook page, and just say what you think and talk back and forth. Comment on each other's comments. What resonated with you? What did you find interesting? What did it remind you of? And as usual, if you enjoyed this podcast, please go on and rate and subscribe on iTunes. And we'll look forward to talking next week. We're going to do chapters 5 and 6. Have a lovely week, you all.
Bye, everyone.